From the Sky News Centre at 5, police have until later this evening to question Joanna Yates's landlord about her death. Forensic officers today returned to the block of flats in Bristol where she lived. Retired public school teacher Chris Jeffries was arrested yesterday. Our reporter Robin Powell is there and says the police deadline runs out at 7 o'clock.
They then would have to apply for a further extension, which would be granted by local magistrates. So we would expect to hear in the next hour or two whether or not they're going to have to apply for that extension.
4,400 people remain without water in Northern Ireland this New Year's Eve. The Water Board's warning it could be next week before more remote areas have fresh water running through their pipes. Fresh water supplies have been sent to Northern Ireland from both Scotland and the Republic. 738 patients are in intensive care in England's hospitals suffering from flu. That's up from 460 this time last week. It appears the cold weather and barometric pressure isn't being kind to the clock that really matters on New Year's Eve. Millions rely on the chimes of Big Ben being accurate at midnight. Checks this morning revealed the mechanism that operates the bell was running a second slow, described as extremely unusual. One of three clockmakers who works there, Paul Robeson, says they rely on traditional methods to put the pendulum right.
What we have is a tray up near the top of the pendulum, and by adding a penny, pre-decimal, an old pre-decimal penny, we can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second a day.
Countries around the world are already welcoming in the new year. Fireworks have been held over the main harbour in Hong Kong. Earlier, Australia saw the new year in style, with a huge display in Sydney which cost £3 million. And it's been confirmed the UK's had its coldest December for 120 years. The average temperature throughout the month, minus 0.6 degrees Celsius. Alton Harrow in Sutherland recorded the lowest temperature. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Mr. Jones is at home, wrapping Christmas presents. I say, Mr. Jones, are you all ready for the Yuletide festivities?
Yes, I think so.
Are you really sure, Mr. Jones? Really, really sure?
Well...
Would you know who to call if you smelt gas at home? Just as I thought, Mr. Jones. You're not ready at all, are you?
Perhaps.
If you smell gas, call the National Gas Emergency Service on 0800 111 999. And remember, Mr. Jones, gas safety isn't just for Christmas, it's for life. Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call 0800 111 999. Save it to your home and mobile phone.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to this special programme, where we hear over the next 2 hours from World War II veteran and MI6 officer Harry Beckhoff. Harry was born in Bristol, now lives in Marlborough and is 96 years of age. He is the longest serving member of the Conservative Party in the entire country, born in February 1914. So Harry will be recollecting the Second World War after we've heard some music.
On the farm, every Friday, on the farm is rabbit pie day. So every Friday that ever comes along, I get up early and sing this little song. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, 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 run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Don't give the farmer his fun, fun, fun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Thank you.
rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, 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 run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Don't give the farmer his fun, fun, fun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run.
From 1939, Flanagan and Allen there with their song Run, Rabbit, Run. MI6 was his employer after and during the Second World War, and he worked for Bletchley Park and GCHQ. So let's hear the first part of my interview with Harry Bekoff.
My name is Harry Bekoff. I was born in Bristol in the St. Paul's district, which was about the poorest part of Bristol, in February 1914. I went to what was called a board school, Eastern School, very primitive elementary school. And from there, I managed to win a scholarship to Fairfield Grammar School. And from Fairfield Grammar School, I won a scholarship to Bristol University. While I was at Fairfield Grammar School, I suffered badly from asthma, and so couldn't get on with my lessons very well, and became, therefore, rather a naughty boy. And most of the teachers didn't want to teach me. And the headmaster said, I think you've got intelligence, but you're going to have to make it on your own. So you're going to have to find two new subjects. I had French and English, two of my best subjects, and the teachers were very happy with me. So I learnt German and Greek in a school which taught neither in about between 12 and 18 months in order to pass the four subjects in the higher school. The French mistress, whose favourite I was, because I have a facility for language, said when she was passing her university exam, she had to have a subsidiary, and German was forced on her, though she hated the language, and so she would help me begin to learn German, but I'd have to do most of the work on my own. She also had a friend called Miss Craigie, who was a graduate of Edinburgh and had Greek subsidiary, which he had to learn in a hurry. And she said to me, I have a secret system. If you follow it, I'll guarantee you'll win without any real knowledge of Greek grammar. The system was to have a huge vocabulary of Greek words and to learn so many per night, per day, per week, until you've rehearsed and rehearsed them, concentrating as hard as possible and repeating them all the way through, so that when you come to look at a Greek exam, the very words leap out at you and the grammar forms itself. And that's where I learnt the art of concentration. So I passed in these two new subjects of German and Greek. And the professor of German at Bristol University was so intrigued at the fact that there was one person offering German from a school which didn't teach German. So he came himself to give me my viva and said, how come? So I explained it to him, and he roared with laughter and said, I'll tell you what, if you'll guarantee to take a German honours degree with me, I'll offer you a place right away. So the naughty boy of Fairfield was the first one to get a place in the university.
Paris, romantic and charming, left all her old companions and faded from view. Lonely men with lonely eyes are seeking her in vain. Her streets are where they were, but there's no sign of her. she has left the Seine. The last time I saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay. I heard the laughter of her heart in every street cafe. The last time I saw Paris, her trees were dressed for spring, and lovers walked beneath those trees, and birds found songs to sing. I dodged the same old taxicabs that I had dodged for years. The chorus of their squeaky horns was music to my ears. The last time I saw Paris, her heart was young and gay. No matter how they change her, I'll remember her that way. Think of happy hours and people who share them, old women selling flowers in markets at dawn, children who applauded Punch and Judy in the park, and those who danced at night and kept their Paris bright till the town went dark. The last time I saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay. I heard the laughter of her heart in every street cafe. The last time I saw Paris, her trees were dressed for spring, and lovers walked beneath those trees, and birds found songs to sing. I dodged the same old taxicabs that I had dodged for years. The chorus of their squeaky horns was music to my ears. The last time I saw Paris, her heart was young and gay. No matter how they change her, I'll remember her. Paris, that way.
From 1941, that was Noel Coward and The Last Time I Saw Paris. Welcome back to this Christmas Day special interview. I'm Tony Gosling, and I'm talking to Bristolian and former MI6 officer Harry Bekoff, who's 96 years of age.
When you learn language principally at a university, you're expected to go to the country and learn the language and as much about the people and the run of the country as possible, and their history, while you're there. I chose to go to Freiburg in the Black Forest because it looked very tempting to me, and I went there in 1933 and witnessed the arrival of Hitler into power. And I saw his Nazi armies. I saw some of the lecturers in the university get dressed in Nazi uniform. That's why I spent more time in the Black Forest than I did in the university. But I witnessed things like burning of books in the marketplace. I saw some dreadful things in Germany. I met many people who were begging me to help them get out of the country. Not a very easy thing to do for a penniless student. And so when I came back to England, I went back to my university, and the Chancellor happened to be a gentleman with the name of Winston Churchill. And Churchill handed me my first degree, and I told him I'd just come back from Germany, and he said, "We'll have a chat afterwards." And that's how I got to know Churchill. And he explained to me what was going on. I learned more in depth in a few meetings with Churchill than I had in the time I'd spent in Germany. So I knew what he was going through, and I knew the problems which faced us.
Just remember this, a kiss is still a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story. A fight for love and glory. A case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time. Never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story. A fight for love and glory. A case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers. Time goes by. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
From 1942, Turner Layton with As Time Goes By. Back now then to my interview with Harry Beckhoff, the longest serving member of the Conservative Party and a former officer for MI6 in World War II.
It was planned for him, and he was put into power. Hitler had no money, had managed to reach the rank of Lance Corporal and Corporal in the German army, though he was Austrian birth, was latterly put in prison, had no money whatsoever, started up this sort of League of Brigands in southern Germany, but there was no money available. However, the powers that be, who came from the Illuminati and were the richest people in the world, beginning with the Rothschilds, whose history needs a complete book in itself, decided that Hitler was the man they were going to put in place in Germany. Part of their plans for the recrudescence of the whole of Europe and, in fact, of the world. That's how he came into power. He had no great education, he had no great knowledge, he had no money, he came from poor parents, his trade was painting, decorating, but he was out of work and in prison for ages. So how does a man like that suddenly vault into power as the prime minister of a country whose great general is just dying?
Many people would say that Hitler's rise to power was really due to the fact that he had a lot of charisma and also that the country was in a terrible economic state and he had promised to get them out of it.
Hitler was promoted by international banks because there were quite a number in America with German antecedents, and by this secret organization which aimed at taking over a whole world government. Well, this was really nothing new because it was also run by the Fabian Society of this country. And the Fabian Society was totally in favour of one world government. So what was begun by the Fabians and previously by the Illuminati and carried on by the Marxists, was taken up by the wealthy people whose desire was to take over the running of the world, and they put Hitler into place. Hitler was the man who would do what they wanted, act as they taught him to act, and produce the result, which was finally a total defeat of Germany, but the recrudescence of the Nazi movement thereafter, as strong as it was during the regime, planned in advance.
Who by? And how do you know that?
The history of the Illuminati, for instance, began with a man who was a Jesuit, a professor, who either was thrown out or left of his own accord. And he's known as the Angel of Light, the fallen angel, the angel who was the greatest, but came into disfavor and turned into the devil. And that's what we've seen ever since, the growth of the power of the devil. Now, the Rothschilds, the richest people in the world, it progressed from there. However, it wasn't only the Rothschilds. There was somebody else lurking inside, and those were the Masons. And the people who worked with the Illuminati and the Rothschilds were the heads of the Masons, up to royal families. Only the heads knew of what was being planned and worked out. The lower levels of the Masons never learnt the truth, and still never have learnt the truth even today.
Well, what you're saying is pretty surprising, because one of the things that Hitler did is he had Freemasonry outlawed.
Hitler had everything outlawed. One of the smartest things he did, and I keep saying that I think he was acting on advice always, because I don't think he had the brains and intelligence to work it out for himself. As soon as he got into power in 1933, he passed a Bill of Rights which gave him dictator status, by which he had the power to dismiss all other parties, all the trade unions, all other organizations, and thus became sole dictator. Isn't that what this New World Order is after today? It's the same vein running all the way through. And the people they've used from the days of the Kaiser and Hitler right up to the present presidents of the United States of America, who certainly since Eisenhower have all been chosen and put in place by these very same people.
Writing you from somewhere in France, hoping this finds you well. Sergeant says I'm doing fine, a soldier and a knob. Here's the song that we'll all sing, this'll make you laugh. We're gonna hang out the washing on the Siegfried line. Have you any dirty washing, mother dear? We're gonna hang out the washing on the Siegfried line, 'cause the washing day is here. The weather may be wet or fine, we'll just rub along without a care. We're gonna hang out the washing on the Siegfried line, if the Siegfried line's still there.
Oi, Bert, where do we hang out our washing? Right over there, Elf.
What, over there? Blimey, Bert, that's the Siegfried line.
Yes, but that's where we're hanging them all.
Yeah, but Johnny mightn't like it.
Oh, Sergeant.
Hello, hello, who wants me?
Oh, Sergeant, some cat's taken my sentence, sir.
All right, well, here, one of you mugs, lend him a bit of carbolic. And by the way, which one of you is washing my smalls?
You're what, Sergeant?
You heard me the first time. I said me smalls, me bits and pieces.
Oh, oh. Hang out washing on the Siegfried line. Have you any good the washing, brother dear?
Billy Cotton and his band with We Are Gonna Hang Out the Washing on the Siegfried Line from the war years. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm talking to Bristolian and former MI6 officer Harry Bekoff.
You remember a man called Churchill? He wrote about the Germans and said, the Germans have been belligerent for 2,000 years and they never change. And it all began about the year 800 with Karl der Große, Charlemagne to you, who was the head of the Franks, who became the Germans. Now, these were not a cohesive country of cohesive people. This was a wild tribes of Germans. The name Germani was given them by the Romans. And the Germani name means the warlike people. Now, about 800, the Pope was in terrible trouble, actually being beaten up, and he was rescued by Karl der Große, Charlemagne, and fully rescued from what could have been his death. As a reward, he made Charlemagne Holy Roman Emperor, and the Germans have regarded themselves ever since as the Holy Roman Empire. When Charlemagne was followed later by Otto, he wanted also to be the Holy Roman Emperor, and the Pope was not in favour. But fortunately for Otto, the same Pope was in trouble again and was beaten up, and Otto saved him, so he also was crowned Holy Roman Emperor, and it's gone ever since. That's why Germans always regard themselves as the Holy Roman Empire. And in fact, they are the secret army of the Pope. What I saw in 1933 as a young undergraduate from Bristol University was the effect the Weimar Republic's collapse and the money situation in Germany was so bad that they were prepared almost to take any leader. And by the way, the Germans have to have a leader. Without a leader, they have revolution. They cannot contend themselves without it. That's why they took eagerly to Hitler, because he assumed the role of a dynamic leader and promised them he would get them out of the Weimar situation where the currency collapsed and day-to-day living was terrible. And of course, you know, he started building great roads and bridges and enterprises to produce a lot of work. But the day-to-day living in Germany at the time I was there was none too happy. Quite a lot of the Germans were scared about this Nazi group marching around the streets in their uniform and rather behaving brutally. But Hitler had this wonderful power of speech, which is, I imagine, what attracted those who put him in place first noticed. And he had this hypnotic glare when he was making his speeches, and this ability to control the crowds and have them follow him. And that's what I noticed beginning to grow in Germany. It's a people reacting from the collapse of the Weimar Republic, thankful that they got themselves a new dynamic leader and beginning to respond to him.
Can you tell us what the economic conditions were like in 1933 in Germany?
It was none too good. It was something like our conditions after the First World War, where we touched almost near bankruptcy because we'd expended everything on winning that terrible war. Well, they were recovering from the Weimar Republic, and they were in a state of semi-poverty from which they were being rescued by Hitler, not by himself. Where did Hitler get the money to build all the roads? The money was supplied all the way through by the international banks, and that's a story in itself, which I have also written about, how the money was produced, how the people were discovered who could carry out the sort of work that had to be done to restore the Germans. And immediately they saw, for instance, the building of the new roads, great Autobahn, something completely new in history, the thousands and thousands of people being employed. This made a terrific effect upon the people, and they could see the glimmer of hope for the future. That's why so many followed Hitler, the new saviour, the Führer.
Coming back to Churchill, can you tell me about your meetings with him and what sort of a chap he was?
Well, when I was in Germany, I was so upset by some of the things I saw, like the burning of the books in the marketplace and the brutal behaviour. The attitudes of the Jews hadn't yet commenced in 1933. But there were plenty who felt uncomfortable and wanted to get out. So I began to write articles for British newspapers about my experiences in Germany, and there were quite a number of things of interest, and not a single one would accept any article. Their general attitude was to write back and say, if they did reply, we are covered by our local agent. When I explained this to Churchill, he smiled and said, that's only a slight beginning of the troubles I've had to suffer. And then he began to tell me what he had to suffer in Parliament, in the newspapers, on all agencies. For instance, before he became Chancellor of Bristol University, he had in fact been invited to Edinburgh University, he told me. And when he tried to make a speech there, he was booed and shouted off and screamed at, so he had to leave in a hurry. That's the sort of attitude that was going on in this country to Churchill. He was thrown out of Parliament, practically. Nobody would listen to him, but he was strong enough and knowledgeable enough to know that what he was doing and saying and thinking was the truth. And he said to me, you must never give up. War is coming and we must be prepared. He advised me to join the officers' training unit in Bristol University, which I did. Churchill from then on became my hero. And although people loved to bring out his faults, and they were numerous, for instance, it isn't generally known that he was a great gambler, in addition to being a great smoker. He had his weaknesses, but by Jove, he had his strengths. He was the man who saved us, saved our country.
Well, what do you put that down to? Why was it that Churchill could see what was happening in Nazi Germany, whilst many other people in Britain were really into appeasement?
Well, he came from a good family. He was well-educated at Harrow and continued his education and experience of life, And he was a courageous, even daring fellow. You know, he thrust himself into the war. He was prepared for any action, any time. He had tremendous courage. He fought the Boers and was chased by them. He wrote extremely well. He was learned, a good writer. He wrote for newspapers. He was a good all-round Englishman. And he loved his country, and his family, of course, had wonderful history before him. Yes, he had his faults, but what a man he was. And he stood up to all the hammering that was given to him. He was First Lord of the Admiralty. They threw him out. Chamberlain had him relegated to the back benches. They humiliated him in Parliament. He stood up to it all and never gave in.
I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own, a doll that other fellows cannot steal. And then the flirty, flirty guys with their flirty, flirty eyes will have to flirt with dollies that are real. When I come home at night, she will be waiting. She'll be the truest doll in all this world. I'd rather have a paper doll to call my own than have a fickle-minded real-life girl. I guess I had a million dolls or more. I guess I played the dog game for and all. I just quarreled with Sue. That's why I'm blue. She's gone away and left me just like all dolls do. I'll tell you boys, it's tough to be alone. And it's tough to love a doll that's not your own. I'm through with all of them. I'll never fall again. Say, boy, what you gonna do? I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own, a doll that other fellows cannot steal. And then the flirty, flirty guys with their flirty, flirty eyes will have to flirt with dollies that are real. When I come home at night, she will be waiting. She'll be the truest doll in all this world. I'd rather have a paper doll to call my own than have a fickle-minded real-life girl.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to this Christmas Day special interview with Harry Beckoff, former MI6 officer, born in Bristol, now living in Marlborough. I'm Tony Gosling. So let's hear more now from Harry. When you came back from Germany, back to Bristol, to the university, what did you do then?
Well, I had my courses to finish in languages and philology. That's the history of language. I joined the Officers' Training Corps of Bristol University and had some hard training there, which entitled me to a commission in the event of war. It was good, solid infantry training, like territorials, so that by the time you'd finished and got Certificate A and B, you were fully entitled to be an officer, and you had to sign an oath that you would offer your services if ever war came. I did other things, of course. I was head of the Students' Union for a short time. I ran plays. I wrote all sorts of articles. I indulged in my own enjoyments. And in 1935, I took my final degree, moved to London, tried to persuade War Office that I was entitled to a commission, and I warned them that I thought war was imminent, and they wrote back a series of postcards saying, didn't agree, nothing to worry about, everything is quiet, everything's in order, we'll notify you if and when necessary. And they never did. So that in the end, I actually enlisted in despair in the ranks.
Until I tell her that I'll never roam.
So, Chattanooga, choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
all aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga, choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, choo-choo.
Glenn Miller and his orchestra with Chattanooga Choo Choo. Now back to my interview with Harry Bekov, Bristolian and former MI6 officer. This is how he got involved with the Codebreakers of Bletchley Park.
I had many adventures during the war, as you can read in my book, and from being an artillery officer, because I wasn't left very long in the engineers when they discovered about my university career, I was sent to Catterick and trained as an artillery officer. Finally, I enlisted, as I say, and my career in the army began from there. And it lasted 10 years. Now, 10 years wasn't the whole time of the war. The war finished in 1945. During that time, I was serving as a codebreaker because Bletchley Park had discovered me in India, learnt about my knowledge of German, and I became a codebreaker with Bletchley Park, who, at that time, in 1941, were not able to produce the sort of quick translations which they were able later to do, especially worrying about what was going on in the desert campaign with the Eighth Army. So I was sent to a small group with the Eighth Army to break Rommel's German ciphers. And we not only broke them, but were able to supply Montgomery with all the necessary information about Rommel's strength and weakness, his generals, projected moods, forward or back, until the victory of Alamein. Then I was recalled to India to join what was called the Western Wireless Association, which was also part of Bletchley. And I finished up with the 14th Army in Burma trying to break Japanese codes. Although I knew no Japanese and had to try to learn something in a hurry. To begin with, the desert campaign, we were fighting, first of all, Mussolini and his Italian army, which we were able to wipe up pretty quickly. Unfortunately, a lot of the Eighth Army warriors were then sent elsewhere on a special service before Rommel came in. So we had a much tougher battle once he arrived. And the battle went up and down through 1,000 miles of the Western Desert, sometimes the Germans and the Italians chasing us, sometimes our chasing them. That lasted through three English generals until we finally got Montgomery, and then we planned the final Eighth Army battle at El Alamein, in which Rommel was finally beaten and forced to retreat against Hitler's orders, it must be said. As usual, when Rommel appealed to Hitler for supplies, the answer he got was, every man must stand and fight for the German cause. But Rommel was wise enough to know that if he stood and fought, he'd be completely and finally defeated. So he upped and made his way as fast as possible back through the desert towards Italy. In the meantime, I had done my job breaking the German codes, but Bletchley also had associations all round other parts of the world, specifically in India and, of course, in Burma, where the Japanese were attacking in great strength.
Can you give us an example of how the sort of work that was being done by Bletchley Park and by you was able to affect the outcome of a battle?
Bletchley Park was composed from about 1938 of some of the top brains of British University, especially Oxford and Cambridge, scientists, mathematicians, linguists. They culled the universities, picked the best brains, and sent them to this quiet place at Bletchley Park, which was off the beaten track and was kept completely secret through the war. During the First World War, we'd broken German intelligence, not with the use of machinery, as happened in the Second World War, but by natural intelligence of men and women. But here we had the use of men with scientific knowledge who were able to build machines to deal with the German wonderful new codes run on machines like the Enigma. The Germans were absolutely, completely assured that their machine, cipher machine, could never be broken. The fact that it was the best-kept secret of the war. And when you think that we were employing by the end of the war something like 10,000 people, not, of course, code breakers, they were just a handful, but the main part were women. all had to swear this oath of silence all through the war in every way, not to breathe or give a hint. And for 30 years thereafter, for over 30 years, and nobody ever breathed a word or broke the silence. And they say women can't keep secrets.
Why do you whisper green grass? Why tell the trees what ain't so? Whispering grass, the trees don't have to know. No, no. Why tell them all your secrets? Who kissed there long ago? Whispering grass, the trees don't need to know. Don't you tell it to the breeze, 'cause she will tell the birds and bees, and everyone will know, because you told the blabbering trees. Yes, you told them once before. It's no secret anymore. Why tell them all the old things? They're buried under the snow. Whispering grass, don't tell the trees, 'cause the trees don't need to know.
Now don't you tell it to the breeze, 'cause she'll run and tell it to the birds and bees, and everyone'll know, because you done told the blabbering trees. Yes, you did. You told them once before. So that's why it ain't no secret anymore.
Why tell them all the old things? They're buried under the snow. Whispering grass, don't tell the trees, 'cause the trees don't need to know.
The X-Spots there with Whispering Grass. Welcome back to this Christmas Day special interview with Harry Beckoff. I'm Tony Gosling, talking to this former MI6 officer. How does the sort of intelligence that you were gathering, how does it actually affect the tactics and the strategy when it comes to fighting a battle?
Well, the first thing you learn is that first wonderful Battle of Britain. Do you remember with the RAF and the Spitfires? The knowledge of what was happening and what the Germans were planning, who had several times more aircraft and trained pilots than us, because they'd been training immediately after the end of the First World War. You know, I maintain that after every defeat, the Germans immediately begin to rearm. They never waste a day. So by the time Hitler came into power, the Prussian army was in full strength and ready to hand for him. And, of course, they had their own Luftwaffe, their own aircraft, all through the years developed in great strength. How on earth they eventually were defeated by our RAF Spitfires and other planes, which were only a portion of their strength, was due to the fact that we'd broken the Luftwaffe codes by then, and were able to notify their chief as to what was going on. Not only with breaking the codes, but we also had a skilled scientist called Jones, a young man who was able to discover the lines of progress along which their aircraft flew to their targets. And he developed a means of breaking those so that they not only later dropped their bombs in the wrong places, but became confused themselves as to where their targets really lie. In other words, we had some wonderful British brains which solved so many problems and were able to defeat the much bigger Luftwaffe. Now, that was due to intelligence. Later on with the bombers, we were able to inform Bomber Harris exactly where the best routes were to the targets, what the strength was of the Luftwaffe in the area, and how to deal with them. Well, it was made slightly easier by the fact that although the Luftwaffe had their own code system, when you're flying in planes in battle, you really don't have much time to send slow messages in code. You burst out your commands as fast and as loudly as possible. And we picked up those, and therefore we learnt an awful lot about what was going on and were able to direct our Spitfire pilots and Hurricanes as to how to deal with them. Therefore, the first breakage for us which came through was the Luftwaffe. After that, we had to deal with the army, and that took slightly longer. But with the help of Poles, and that's a long but different story of how the German first breakdown of the Enigma machine fell into Polish hands, and Polish intelligence were able to discover exactly how the machine was put together, and eventually gave us a copy of the sort of machine itself. That, of course, didn't do anything to break it. That had to be done later on. But it gave you an idea of the makeup of the machine and how the German code machine was working. With that knowledge, you could work out how to break into it. I would advise you to suggest to all people you know to go to Bletchley, which still exists and is being repaired and replaced. And there you will see the sort of machinery which we were using, including the first computer. Now, you know what a computer's like. You can get a computer today which fits into the palm of your hand. Well, the first computer which we built with the aid of the post office engineers, and we called the Green Goddess, actually covered a whole room from floor to ceiling. And it's been rebuilt, and it's there to be seen, and you can actually see it working. And I recommend anybody who's listening to me and is interested in how we broke the German codes and actually defeated them, because Eisenhower wrote to our chief and said, "Thank you, you have saved at least 2 years of the war." So it had good effect. It's worth having a look at Bletchley and seeing one of the great wonders of World War II. We were a small number of people chosen from universities. It doesn't take an awful lot of people because they get in each other's way. It takes a lot of helpers who do all the donkey work and the jobs. The Wrens we employed were absolutely magnificent in working in all the heat of these great electrical machines with power pouring out day by day, night after night, in working in shifts. But there was only really a handful of code breakers doing the actual work.
I'm Tony Gosling, and I've been talking to Bristolian and former MI6 officer Harry Beckhoff.
Listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody